today, before we start the shir, it's cold. Bahar, page 696. Before we start the shir, today's shir is going to be dedicated to the yard site of Melanie's father, David ben Moshe, whose yard site is today, 10 years ago. So the learning we do today is going to be in the merit of his neshamas, and his neshamas should have an aliyah, and the whole family should be blessed with only long life and good things. I just mentioned to Melanie before that I didn't realize it's a very special yard site, because today is Lag BaOmer. And I wanted to dedicate today's shir also to Lag BaOmer, but a little bit of the parsha as well, so we'll mix and match of it. What we'll do is we'll connect the parsha a bit to Lag BaOmer.
This of my shir was on 53 and 54 days. I'm lost. Totally lost.
What's it?
This issues of 33 days or 54 days.
Oh, mourning, in terms of mourning. People, some people, yeah.
I really got to get lost a long way.
Okay. So this week's parsha is it's a double parsha. So people can. Melanie brought some cake and some juice and stuff. So if people make a bracha, the bracha should also be in the merit of the neshama. That's the minhag. That's why we make a bracha on the yard. Yeah. So it's a double parsha today. Bahar b'chukaisa. And as I said, it's also Lag BaOmer today, the 18th of Iyar, the 33rd day of the Omer, 696, page 696. Lag BaOmer is a very, very special day of great simcha. Just this morning when I got up, I checked on one of the websites. They have live streams to Meiron. You can actually see thousands and thousands of people. Yeah, if you ask me after, I'll show you where it is. And just there's thousands of people there, and they dance all night, and they dance all day, and it's unbelievable. It's
like
they take boys, they have their first haircut there, and lots of different customs that are associated with Lag BaOmer. So I want to try and talk about Lag BaOmer a little bit and understand the nature of its simcha. And connected to the parsha as well. So, I'll take a thought from the parsha, which will be connected to the whole theme of Lag BaOmer. Let's first learn a bit of the parsha, and see what it does and develop a theme. So, page 696. The first mitzvah in this week's parsha, the famous mitzvah, is the mitzvah of Shmita. Mitzvah of seven, every 7 years, the land lying fallow and not worked, etc. So let's have a look at the way the Torah says it. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe. So Hashem spoke to Moshe, Bahar Sinai Lemar. On Har Sinai, saying. Now you have to understand, this is much, much after Matan Torah, right? The giving of the Torah. So the obvious question is, how does Har Sinai get into the picture? And we'll talk about that in a moment. So, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Bnei Yisrael, Ve'amar to Aleim, and say to them, Ki Savo el Aretz, when you come to the land, Asher ani noisein lechem, which I will give you. V'shofso ha'aretz, the land should rest. Shabbos la'Hashem, a Shabbos for Hashem. Sheishanim tizra sadecha, 6 years you shall sow your field. Sheishanim tizmer kamecha, 6 years you should prune your vineyards. V'asafto estvasa, and gather the produce. V'ashona ha'shvi'is, in the 7th year, Shnas Shabbos on Yehil Earth. It should be a day of rest, a year of rest. It's like a Shabbos for the land. Shabbos Lashem. Sot Choloi Sizra, your field, you shall not sow. Chama Choloi Sizra, and your vineyard, you shall not prune, etc., etc. Then the next paragraph, the Torah goes through the mitzvah of Yovel, the Jubilee year. Right? Just have a look. If you look at Pasuk Ches, which is the 8th, verse 8, yeah? It says, "V'safarta lecha, you shall count for you sheva shapsois shanim, 7 cycles of 7, sheva shanim sheva pa'amim, 7 years 7 times, right? V'hu lecha shimei sheva shapsois hashanim, in the days of your 7 cycles of the sabbatical, teisha ve'arboim shana, 49 years, and in the 50th year should be the year of Yovel. Of course, that 50th year, the year of Yovel." Is also connected with the Omer. Everything's connected. It's quite amazing, right? We always read this during the Omer, and of course it's connected because the relationship between the number 50 and the number 49 we find with regard to the Omer as well. I'll just digress from it and just explain that actually. In Yiddishkeit we find an interesting thing that the number 49, the relationship between the number 49 and 50, right? And we see that from Shavuos. We count 49 days of the Omer, and the 50th day is Shavuos, right? In the Torah, there's an interesting thing. It says, when it talks about the mitzvah of counting the Omer in last week's parasha, which we touched upon, it says, one place it says you should count 50 days. The other place says you should count 49 days, 7 weeks. Right? But it does say, Tisperu Chamishiv Yom, you should count 50 days. But we don't count 50 days, we count 49 days. Right? And the explanation is always given, which is the following, and that is like this. The goal is to reach 50. 50 in Yiddishkeit is a number of transcendence. It relates to things. There's certain numbers, like 1, 8, 50, they're all related. Those are numbers which are called numbers of transcendence, which means numbers which represent things that are impossible to reach through the natural cycle of this world. Right? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, there's a certain relationship between Hashem and the world, where He interacts with the world, but on certain levels. Because Hashem created a design of the universe called nature, Teva. That nature is a nature where we can appreciate Hashem through that system, but in a very limited way. Hashem is concealed through that system. In fact, the word Teva, for nature in Hebrew, comes to the word mutbat, to be sunken in. God's presence is sunken into the existence. It's not apparent, it's not obvious. Right? In fact, the name for world in Hebrew is Olam, right? Like Olam Hazeh. And Olam in Hebrew comes from the same word as Helem, to conceal. This world conceals God, right? So there's within the world, through looking through the eyes of nature and the cycle of nature, we can reach certain connection with Hashem, but it's somewhat limited. Now the cycle of nature is hinted in the number 7. Right? Everything in this world is number 7, as we know. 7 days of the week, 7 years of the Shemitah, 7 weeks of Sefiras HaOmer. The Maharal points out that every object has 7. There's the top and the bottom, the fourth side, and then the essence, the core. Okay, there's 7 emotions that govern our existence. The whole world is created in a cycle of 7 days of the week, of course, right? The number 8 is the number which represents that level where we reach beyond nature, beyond Teva. The number of transcendence, where we reach higher than is naturally possible. Right? And the number 50 does the same thing. The number 50 is also, because number 50 represents the number after 49, which is 7 times 7. Because the number 7 in its completion is 7 times 7. Right? Because every one of our emotions, we know, is subdivided into the further 7. So that 7 times 7 is the ultimate perfect number 7. Right, the number 7 is ultimately in 49. Number 50, therefore, is the number of transcendence. The way it works is like this. Our goal is not to be limited by this. Right? Our goal is not to be limited by the cycle of nature. Our goal is to reach beyond the nature. By the way, that's the idea of a circumcision, the bris milah of an 8th day. That's why it pushes away Shabbos. Shabbos is the ultimate perfection of the number 7. Right? Shabbos represents a perfect world, perfect cycle of nature. The bris represents the transcendent bond between us and God, which supersedes nature and therefore overrides Shabbos. And if Shabbos is on the 8th day, it overrides Shabbos. Right? So our goal is to reach transcendence, is to reach 8, is to reach 50, etc. But 50 is a number that we cannot reach on our own, because we are limited by our own natural cycle, our own natural limitations. Right? So ultimately, those levels represented, the number 8, the number 50, are levels which are given to us by God. It's levels which we get given as a present. It's not something we can actually earn, because we can only earn what's within our capabilities, right? And therefore, when we do reach those levels of 50 and 8 and all those levels that represent that transcendent bond, those levels have to be given to us. Right? However, they're only given to us if we do as much as we can. So we earn it on some level. In other words, we have to perfect the 7, or we have to perfect the 49. When we perfect the 49, only then and only then, we get given the number 50. Okay? Yeah, is that clear? Which that reconciles the whole difference of countings in the Torah. One place says in the Torah you've got to count 50 days. Because that's what we do need to do. Our goal is to reach 50. The Torah was given on the 50th day. Shavuos takes place on the 50th day. That's the ultimate goal, to rise above what we're capable of. But we don't actually count the 50th day, because that's given to us. Right? That's given to us. Sorry. Thank you, yeah. Right? That gets given to us. That's why we actually don't count Shavuos. We don't count the 50th day. And the Torah says count 50 days because it means you have to reach there, you have to get there. But you don't actually count the 50th day because the 50th day gets given to you after you do the 49. So that's why the one pasuk says count 50 because that's where you got to go. But the system is you count 49. You perfect the 49 and the 50th gets given to you. Yeah. Which is exactly the same process that get given over here. Torah says you've got to keep a Shemitah. You've got to keep the cycle of seven, right? Then you've got to count 7 years, seven times seven. When you count seven times seven, then the 50th year becomes holy. That's the Yovel year, that ultimate Jubilee year, which is holy, but that's sort of a gift from Hashem, right? But that's after you do the 49. Same relationship between Sfiras Omer. The difference is that in this Yovel thing, the mitzvah of counting was on the Beis Din. They had to count the 49 years. The mitzvah of Sfiras Omer is individual mitzvah. Everyone has to count the 49 years. Okay. Now. Yes. Winter has arrived. Okay. Now. I just want to show you one thing before we go on to Lag BaOmer and we connect it to the Parsha. Have a look on page 700. You used to see the mitzvah of Shemitah was a challenging mitzvah. And is a challenging mitzvah. By the way, Shemitah is still observed today in Eretz Yisrael, as you know. There's a whole discussion if it's biblical or rabbinic, but the bottom line is it's obligatory. And it's still observed. And today there's a huge, in fact, since the last, you know, since the establishment of the state, or since Jews are returning to Israel, there's been a tremendous return to this whole mitzvah and a great awareness and consciousness. And today there's, first of all, there's huge funds in America, all over the world, to subsidize the religious farmers. Because it's a very challenging mitzvah. You have to understand, you've got to shut down business for a year. Right? And the Torah recognizes the challenge. I want to show you this, right? If you look in page 700, pasuk chaf, verse 20. Right? The pasuk says like this: "V'chi soimru," and if you will say, says the Torah, "Ma noichal b'shana hashvis?" What are we going to eat the seventh year? Right? "Hein lo nizra," we have not sown. We haven't gathered in the produce. It's an amazing pasuk. This Torah says, if you will say, what are we going to eat? In other words, the Torah is not ignoring the challenge. The Torah is saying, you're going to have this problem. This is a supernatural thing. The demand on you to keep Shemitah is a tremendous challenge to your faith, to your emunah. Because you will have the question. You know, when Torah says something, it's not just Torah is like, everything in Torah is true. In other words, Torah is acknowledging this as a true, legitimate challenge. Right? Says the pasuk, "Vetzivisias brachasi lachem mashana hashishis," I will command my blessing on the sixth year. Ve'asa satvua lishloish hashanim, and the land will produce for 3 years. Because what happens is it's got to be enough for 3 years. Because in the seventh year you don't do business, you don't harvest. You can harvest. I mean, you can go down and eat apples. You can take them off the tree and eat them if you need them for that day. But you can't properly harvest. Which means you don't sow the field the whole of the seventh, which also means it creates a problem for the eighth year. Because the eighth year comes, you haven't sown, you've got to start again. So Hashem needs to give a bracha the sixth year, there should be enough for the sixth, the seventh, and part of the eighth, right? Incidentally, nowadays, there's tremendous stories about the people, the farmers that keep Shemitah, how they recorded tremendous miracles this year, this particular Shemitah, last year. How there was a tremendous drought in some areas, and they weren't affected, and like quite spooky things. We see that the commitment of Shemitah actually brings about the fulfillment of this pasuk. Okay. So that's a general overview of the whole idea of Shemitah, right? Now, let's go back again to page 696 to the first pasuk.
Can I just ask, is there situations in Israel where Jews own land and they don't keep the shmita and they're selling their produce, and what kind of...
No, they don't sell it. They don't sell their produce. There is a very controversial issue which many people are moving away from. In Israel, it's called heter mechira, where there's some heter that you officially sell your land to a non-Jew and then it's done. But there are many, many, many poskim who are very against that and say it doesn't really work, and therefore you really have to keep the proper laws of shmita and just don't. It was a tremendous controversy over the last couple of hundred years. But many people move away from that and actually keep shmita properly. Don't sell the land and just keep it properly.
So that's like the non-form people who own the land. What stops them just...
They don't keep it. And then becomes the whole problem about what fruit you can eat.
Right.
And you have to be very careful. In general, in Eretz Yisrael, it's very... You know, we know that in diaspora, the one thing you can always be safe about is you go into a fruit store and buy an apple, right? You don't have to check the hechsher, you don't have to this, right? You know, meat, products, ingredients, okay, it's all complicated. But we know, one thing we say, fruit and vegetables, right? You know, it's a sure, fruit and vegetables are the most complicated thing. In general, not only shmita. Because first of all, there's all kinds of laws that govern it. If it's fruit, it has to be sure it's not from the first 3 years. It can be arla. You also have to make sure that there was truma and miser, all the tithes and the various separations were separated from it. Right? And then shmita, there's a nightmare. I mean, because there's a number of things. First of all, there's how you sell. There is a whole way of selling fruits and vegetables also during shmita. If it officially comes from the base thin, like it's a communal thing, they go and collect it, and then they sell it. But then you also all the fruits and vegetables, if it does come from shmita, has the holiness of shmita. There's a whole system of how you have to eat fruits and vegetables during shmita, right? If it comes from Israeli land, because it's got a kedusha, like you're not allowed to throw away. You're not allowed to throw things away during shmita. The way it works over there, it was last year, right? The way it works is that some people have special rubbish bins for shmita. Because you actually not, let's say you eat a banana and you're not in the mood of the whole banana, or an orange, you're not in the mood of the whole orange, so there's a little piece left over. So you know, throw it away. You have to put it in a special place and it's got to decompose until it becomes not edible, and only then you can throw it away. So they have special cans and things like that. And it applies for all sorts of things, like you're making gefilte fish and there's carrot juice in the gefilte fish. You've got to think about all these things, right?
You can't just compost it.
No, you've got to actually put it in a special place. It's a whole system. It's a whole business.
Also, with restaurants having people leaving half their meals.
Yeah, and it's very good. So there's all kinds of guidelines. I'm not familiar with all the guidelines myself because I never lived there during shmita, but it's fascinating, right? Anyway, that's the law of shmita. We get product. You'll notice, I don't know, I just noticed the other day, in fact. You'll notice some things, some products that come out of Eretz Yisrael that will tell you, like the very reliable Hashem, like the Badatz, for example, right? You will notice, because there's a whole problem, even if they do acquire the Shmita produce halachically, which there are ways of doing that, there becomes a whole nother problem of taking it out of Eretz Yisrael. You're not actually really allowed to take Shmita food out of Eretz Yisrael if it actually grew there, right? So we get a lot of products from Eretz Yisrael, or wine, for example. You'll notice some of the very reliable hechsherim, it actually has a stamp on the bottom of the hechsher. It says Yevul Chutz La'aretz. The produce is from Chutz La'aretz. It's not from Eretz Yisrael. They imported from, I don't know where, from where. Right, which in itself is a whole controversy in Eretz Yisrael, because it's a philosophical, moral, emotional debate about, you know, could you support the Arabs by importing food from there? It's a very complicated story and really many different views. And then
that's easy with the Jews.
No, it's never easy. That's what makes it exciting. It's never complicated. Okay, so let's go back to the first pasuk. The first pasuk says that Hashem spoke to Moshe by Dabar Hashem Moshe Bahar Sinai Leimar, on Har Sinai saying. So Rashi brings the famous question, right? Ma inyan shmita etzel Har Sinai. What has shmita got to do with Har Sinai? Right? That's the phrase of Rashi. Ma inyan shmita etzel Har Sinai. What has shmita got to do with Har Sinai? All the mitzvahs were given Har Sinai. What do you mean Hashem spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai? Everything comes from Har Sinai. Our whole existence comes from Har Sinai. Our whole Torah comes from Har Sinai. This phrase, by the way, this question became such a catchphrase that it's now used in people who sort of learn and in learning, in yeshivas, it's a very common phrase. When someone will say something that has no connection to what the discussion is, someone will say, what's Shmita got to do with Har Sinai? Even though the discussion is with Shmita, it became like a phrase of when you question someone's relevance or something's relevant. Say, Ma'in Shmita, Eitz Har Sinai. So what does Rashi answer? Rashi says that it's coming to teach us that just because this parsha, like this, we read about the Torah being given at Sinai, right? But we've never read in the Torah about all the specifics of the mitzvahs coming from Sinai. We remember, we think about Har Sinai as this unbelievable revelation, Hashem revealing Himself and talking about the Ten Commandments and giving the fundamentals of the Torah. But what is the connection between the specifics, the details of Torah, and halacha with Har Sinai? So what the Torah does here is, it tells us all the specific laws of Shemitah, right? All the specific laws of Shemitah, and it says, it connects it to Har Sinai. To teach us, says Rashi, that just like Shemitah, we see the Torah emphasizes. And not only the generalities, but even the specifics and the details were given in Har Sinai, so too with the whole Torah, everything general and specific all comes from Har Sinai. All comes from the revelation of Har Sinai. Which answers the question partially, okay? But the one question remains. That's very nice that the Torah needs to do that, but why choose Shemitah for that? Why choose Shemitah for that concept? In other words, why do we need to learn this lesson specifically from the mitzvah of Shemitah? Why can Hashem do this with another mitzvah? The mitzvah of Tefillin. We could have said Hashem spoke to Moshe Har Sinai about the mitzvah of Tefillin, or the mitzvah of Shabbos, or whatever. Why the mitzvah of Shemitah? Let's leave that question for a little bit, and we'll talk about Lag BaOmer, and then we'll come back and take a thought from Lag BaOmer and answer this question. So just to go back and remind everyone, what's Lag BaOmer? Lag BaOmer is two things. As I mentioned on Shabbos, Lag BaOmer is, first of all, the day that the Shulchan Aruch says that we can ease the mourning a little bit. That, you know, we mourn during this period, but on Lag BaOmer we're a bit more happy because we know that during this time the Talmidim, the disciples of Rabbi Akiva, passed away, 24,000 of them, and on the day of Lag BaOmer they stopped dying. Whatever that means, there's a different interpretations, but they stop dying at Lag BaOmer, and therefore we ease the mourning, and we a bit more hopeful in Lag BaOmer. But in terms of Lag BaOmer's celebration, the main cause of the celebration of the Simcha of Lag BaOmer, and it's an amazing celebration in many places, is the fact that it's the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a tremendously great sage. He was the author of the Zohar. He was the one to begin the process of revealing the secrets of Torah, the esoterics of Torah. And he passed away on this day. He passed away on this day in the most unbelievable way. There's a whole story. He gathered together his Talmidim. He said that he's going to reveal things he's never revealed before, and they gathered around him, and he spoke, and he ended with the word Chaim. The last word he said was the word life, and there was this fire that came around his house, and it was just an amazing thing, and they looked up, and he was smiling, and his neshama left his body. Right? And he specifically requested that the day of his passing should be a day of Simcha, and should be a day of tremendous celebration, and he called it the day of his celebration because he said that on that day he had reached the ultimate bond with Hashem. That's what it says in the Zohar, that he reported that he had reached the ultimate connection with Hashem, and therefore that day was a day of tremendous simcha for him, and he said that that simcha would be a simcha shared with the rest of the world, and anyone who celebrates his yahrzeit would be blessed with tremendous simcha, right? Tremendous bracha. Just to tell you a story of how great his simcha is, there was a story in the times of the Arizal. The Arizal once took his disciples to Meiron, because people go to Meiron today, to the gravesite of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and celebrate Lag BaOmer. They've done this for generations, right? And the Arizal had a disciple called Rabbi Avraham. And this Rabbi Avraham was a great man, but he was always plagued by the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. This was his thing, right? To the point that he was so upset about the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that he would recite a tefillah every single day called Nachem. Now, Nachem is a prayer that we say on Tisha B'Av, right? So it's obviously a very sad prayer. It's a prayer that talks about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the belief that Hashem will ultimately bring the Beis HaMikdash back. So he said he used to say this tefillah of Nachem every single day, including Shabbos and Yontif. When he went to Meiron and he joined the Arizal in the festivities of Lag BaOmer, he continued his practice. So during davening or during benching, he said Nachem. Afterwards, the Arizal, the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai appeared to the Arizal in a dream. That's what the Arizal relates. And he said, I want you to know that it was very wrong what your disciple did, because how dare he interfere with my simcha? That just shows you how great the simcha of Lag BaOmer is. That he brought in this concept, even though he would say Nachem every day, Shabbos, Yontif, this guy was so, right? But that wasn't so bad. But to say it on Lag BaOmer, to talk about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash in Lag BaOmer, that was terrible. And the story actually goes, it doesn't have a happy ending. It affected the disciple and he was actually punished. Right? But it just goes to show the tremendous simcha, the tremendous celebration of Lag BaOmer. What was unique about Rav Shimon bar Yochai? Rav Shimon bar Yochai was a tremendously spiritual person. One of the unique factors of Rav Shimon bar Yochai in his life, that he was one of the authors of the Mishnah, he was one of the Tanaim, right? But we found amongst his peers that the Tanaim, there were two types. There were those Tanaim, there were those rabbis that were very well versed in the revealed part of Torah, in the halachic part of Torah, right? And we find them all over the Gemara. Then there were certain individuals like Rav Nechunya ben Akona, for example, who was a Kabbalist. Chunim ben Akona wrote even a book on Kabbalah. But the thing is that his main speciality was in mysticism, and we actually don't find him that much in the Talmud, in the halachic part of Torah, because his speciality was in the hidden part of Torah, and we don't find. One of the unique things about Rav Shimon bar Yochai is he was both. In the Gemara, he is all over the place in halacha. All over, every section of Talmud has Rav Shimon in it. And he was the author of the Zohar, and he joined together, he created a bond between those two parts of Torah. Now, there's a famous story of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, how he spent 12, 13 years in a cave, right? I'm going to share with you the story the way the Gemara tells it. Incidentally, very fascinatingly, this story of Rav Shimon bar Yochai is in the Masechta Shabbos, the tractate of Shabbos in the Gemara, on the 33rd page. Right? So the way it's printed is in the 33rd page. Even more fascinating is that Rabbi Shimon, until this point in the Gemara, for the first 32 pages, Rabbi Shimon is mentioned very often in halachic context about different things that he said. He's mentioned 32 times before this page. Not on every page once, some pages not, some pages more than once. 32 times, and the 33rd is the story, his own story, on the 33rd page of Shabbos, which is going to Lag BaOmer, right? That's
did
the
you
name.
Say he lived in a cave?
I can tell you the story.
No,
Rabbi Akiva wasn't a cave, Rabbi Shimon. People mix that up. Rabbi
Akiva disappeared to study for.
No, that's Rabbi Shimon. And I'll tell you the story. The story goes like this. The Gemara introduces the story. It's a fascinating story itself, so I'll read it to you. The Gemara tells a story like this. How does the Gemara get to the story? You know, Gemara goes from one topic to another. How does it actually come to the story? It comes to the story because it mentions an individual, in this case, not so complimentary actually, called Yehuda ben Gerim. Yehuda ben Gerim was a guy, but he was a bit of a talkative fellow, and he didn't always keep a secret, right? And he had this nickname, called this description called Rosh HaMedabrim. He was the first of the speakers. He was always speaking, right? Says the Gemara, why do they call him that? What earned him that title? So the Gemara tells a story that one day Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, they were all colleagues. Rabbi Yehuda, this is a reference to Rabbi Yehuda bar Eli. By the way, he's also buried in Meiron. They're both buried in Meiron. Says they were. This was the time under Roman rule. It was a very, very tough time for the Jewish people. They were sitting, and Yehuda ben Gerim happened to be sitting next to them. He was eavesdropping into the conversation. And they were discussing the Romans. They were discussing the situation. Rabbi Yehuda said, you know, at the end of the day, the Romans are good guys. Look what they did. The infrastructure they built. They built bridges. They built marketplaces. They built bathhouses. Okay, they're not so friendly to the Jews, but they've done some good. Rabbi Yossi, this is Rabbi Yehuda said that. Rabbi Yossi kept quiet. He had no comment to make. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai got upset. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, no, what are you talking about? They're an immoral people. Whatever they've done is only egocentric. They establish marketplaces for immorality, bathhouses to beautify their own bodies, bridges to collect taxes, and he wasn't very complimentary about the Romans. Okay. The meaning of this discussion needs its own discussion of what was the point of discussing this, what was the different viewpoints, but that's what happened. So this guy, Yehuda ben Gerim, couldn't keep his mouth shut, so he went and he shared this conversation with others, and it got to the Roman officials. Right. So they said like this, Yehuda, that he praised us, we'll promote him, and we'll take care of him. Rabbi Yossi, that kept quiet, they weren't so happy about him keeping quiet, they weren't so happy about his ambivalence that he kept quiet. So they sent him off to exile to a town called Sipuri. They exiled him. However, Rabbi Shimon, he says, who was against us, he needs to be killed. And they were out to catch him. So initially, him and his son, they went to hide in the yeshiva. but that didn't work. And his wife would bring him food every day, but that didn't work, and they really were out to look for him. And he was worried that they would torture his wife and she would spill the beans. So they decided just to run away, that no one should know where they are, and they hid in a cave. They hid in a cave, and they had nothing to eat. So Hashem, a miracle happened, and there was a spring of water and a tree of carobs that grew there. And that's what they ate for 13 years. Not a great menu, but it was... Right? Actually, Minak, some people have, by the way, like Bo'omer to eat carobs because of this. Yeah?
It was
nice. Yeah, sure. Yeah. And they had other Moses, a whole way how they would do it. They would take off their clothes part of the day and they would put themselves in the sand so they wanted to preserve their clothing, and it was a whole thing. Right? And the bottom line is they learned Torah straight. 30 years. Him and his son had this chavrusa and they learned Torah the whole time. Right? After 12 years, Eliyahu Navi came. By the way, the cave, they know, I didn't know this until last night. Last night I was at after finished there, I went to, it was like a fabring, and from someone from Tzvas was talking. Mm-hmm. And Tzvas is right next to Miron. And he just said a few weeks ago, I don't know this, they actually know where the cave is. Mm-hmm. I think it's a place called Piki'in or something. They know where the cave is. He actually went there a few weeks ago, he showed someone, they actually know where the cave of Shimon hid. They even have remnants of the place where the spring was, and I think there's even parts of the tree of the carob tree which still, I don't know if it produces any carobs, but the tree's still there. Mm-hmm. Amazing. It's 2,000 years ago. Roughly. Right? Right? So after 12 years, Eliyahu HaNavi comes and he stands at the opening of the cave and he says, who's going to tell Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai that the Caesar, the emperor, died and the decree has been rescinded? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai understood that it's okay, it's time for him to go out, and he went out. But you have to understand what Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Lazar's situation was when they came out of the cave. What did they do for 12 years, right? They reached the height of spirituality. Even before they went in, they were spiritual people. Right? But their connection to the spiritual world was so intense that they actually had developed an intolerance for the mundane. Right? Because in many places it's actually written, like they elevated themselves to an incredible level. Because you have to understand, because not only did they learn Torah, obviously they didn't work and they didn't do anything, they weren't involved in the physical at all. But it was more than that, they didn't even do mitzvahs. Right? They didn't eat matzah, they didn't take a lulav, and mystics ask this question, like, how do they keep the mitzvahs? And they explain that there's two ways of doing mitzvahs. Sometimes certain tzaddikim in the world that are able to perform mitzvahs in a different way than we perform them. We need to perform them by actually taking a physical piece of matzah or a physical lulav. They were able to perform the mitzvahs, but on a completely spiritual level. They generated the lulav energy in a spiritual way, in a matzah way, right? So you can imagine what kind of beings these were when they come at, right? So they had this intolerance, says the Gemara, for the physical. And they come in, and imagine they see a guy, a farmer, and he's plowing the land. And they think to themselves, what an idiot. Like, here, you know, what... plowing the land, are you crazy? Like you could be learning Torah, right? And the Gemara says like this, that these people are forsaking the pursuit of the life of the world to come and occupying themselves with silly things. And actually, wherever they looked, it says they would burn, like it would be incinerated, that their eyes were like so powerful that they looked at something and looked at a tree and it would be burnt, right? So a heavenly voice came in and said, I didn't take you out of the cave to destroy my world, go back. Right, so they went back for 12 years, they had to retrain themselves. Now, so the 13th year was very, very important. After 13th year, they realized that it's time to go out again, and they were transformed. What had happened in that 13th year? Really, it just should have created more of a problem. Like, they went for a 13th year, another dose of spirituality. Why did it help? The 13th year, they didn't give up the level that they were before. I'm explaining to you how the Pshat and the Gemara is. The 13th year, they learned how to join the intensity of their spirituality and reconcile it with the world. That's what they learned in 13. In fact, it's very significant that it was the 13th year. Because the word Echad is 13. The gematria of the word Echad is 1, which means 1. Hashem Echad is 13, right? 12, like every number represents something else. See, 12 represents like the 12 tribes, right? 12 represents, the number 12 Kabbalistically represents compartmentalization. Everything is in its own department, everything is its own section. Like the 12 tribes, you know, 12 tribes, every tribe had its portion in the land of Eretz Yisrael. In the world of 12, The world of the spiritual and the world of the physical are separate. They don't mix. Spirituality, the physical is the physical, the mundane is the mundane, they're different. So therefore, after 12, they had, everything was boxed in. They were in one world, the farmer was a different world, and there was no connection. What they had to learn was, in the 13th year, was Hashem Echad, the oneness. What Hashem Echad means? The oneness of Hashem means that Hashem is everywhere. In other words, that godliness can be discovered and accessed everywhere. That actually it's all one thing. That you can take the most intense levels of spirituality and bring it down and connect it with the most mundane of situations. The Gemara tells an interesting thing, actually, this is really more Rabbi Shimon was transformed. Rabbi Lazar didn't actually work that much. When they came out, Rabbi Lazar, his son, was still a bit intolerant, and he would still burn things with his gaze, and Rabbi Shimon would fix it. Anyway, so the bottom line is Rabbi Shimon, and then the Gemara says they realized the value of the physical world, the value of doing mitzvahs in a physical way, and the Gemara ends the story with that there was Friday, when they came out of the cave the last time, it was Friday afternoon, and they saw a simple guy running from the marketplace. He was running. What was he doing? It says he was carrying two bundles of hadassim, of myrtles. Yeah? And he was running. It was close to the sunset. So they said to him, well, what's this for? He said to him, it's on a Shabbos. We're taking flowers home. Right? So Shimon said to him, so why two bunches? Why not one bunch? Like, what are you need two bunches of myrtles for? He was trying to figure out what's happening. So the guy said, no, because on Shabbos there's two expressions, Zachor and Shamor, right? You should remember the Shabbos, you should protect the Shabbos. So I'm taking two bunches of flowers. So he turned to his son and says, look how precious the mitzvahs are to these people. And he appreciated that these people, they might not be as learned as in the mountains spiritually, but there was this connection, had such endearment for mitzvahs, right? So that's the concept of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So the idea of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was like this. The life mission afterwards of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai became to bridge the gap, to understand the different worlds, right? And then to open up the barriers between the different worlds. So he did this on all levels. First of all, he did this on the level of Torah, like I said before. He bridged the gap between the esoterics of Torah and the revealed part of Torah. Right? He understood that there were two parts of Torah. There's the revealed halachic part of Torah, and then there's the mysticism and the esoteric part of Torah. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai then understood those two worlds, but then brought them together. Bringing them together, by the way, because it's an interesting thing if you analyze the story of the Gemara. The first 12 years were important. Because when you bring two worlds together, you don't bring them together in a way where you blur the lines. In other words, it's not that there aren't two worlds. There are two worlds. There is the world of the spiritual and the world of the physical. And it's important to understand the distinction. Sometimes in order to bring two things together, you first have to understand the difference. Otherwise, you don't really connect them, you understand? Like bringing spirituality into the physical world, you first have to understand what the spirituality is. You first need Rabbi Shimon's experience of the 12 years. 12 years are important. You first have to have experiences which are purely spiritual. And then once you've understood the difference in the two worlds, then you have to merge them together. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did this on the level of Torah, and he did this in the world as well. And then he went after the 13th year, he was able then to bring those two worlds together, and he was able to bring his intense spiritual connection and influence the people who were farming and doing mitzvahs in the physical way, etc., etc. Okay, so that's Rabbi Shimon's thing. Rabbi Shimon, by the way, just to give you an idea again about his sort of the spiritual intensity of his level, he was from the people, the Gemara says, there were a select few individuals that didn't have to daven. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai only davened once in 30 days. Why? Because the Gemara says that if someone is torasoi umenasoi, which means that he's so involved in Torah study that becomes his whole life, his obsession almost, then he doesn't have to stop learning in order to daven, because learning sort of overrides that. Doesn't apply to most people, but apply to Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon and his select few of colleagues, he actually didn't daven. He only davened once in 30 days. They would stop to daven once in 30 days, right? Because the Torah level was so, they were just in a completely different world. Okay, it just sort of gives you again the concept.
Did his son end up becoming anyone great, whatever?
Yeah, one of the Tanaim, sure. His son is buried also in Iran, by the way. His son is buried, when you go to Rav Shimon's graveside, his son's right next to him, not far, like just a couple of meters away.
So they went back and then they were able to teach the extra stuff.
Sure. Rabbi Elazar, yeah. Rabbi Elazar. And the Gemara is referred to as Rabbi Lazar ben Rav Shimon, like the son of Shimon.
Can you just tell me, you're speaking about that spiritual level and the coming down, well, not coming down, but integrating
kindness. Right.
With regards to today, how do we have that sort of thing? I mean,
so you see,
you've got your communities, for instance, like the Nabrak or Mesh, and say we regard, I mean, the Milwaukee people really on another major level. You never really seem to have much connection with.
Okay, so the way it works is like this. The way the system works for us, the lesson we learned from this is like this. Yeah. This needs to be applied on all levels. Right? You have to have both models. You have to have a model of complete spirituality, and you have to have a model of integrating into the world, right? Because ultimately, that's the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation is to bring God into this world. Right? But this world is relative. In other words, everything's relative, right? So, today, everyone has to do mitzvahs. So you can have a person who's tucked away in the middle of Meir Sharim and he's learning Torah all day. But he also has to do mitzvahs. So on his level, he's to bring him to the world. But you have tzaddikim, for example, who were very spiritual. So in their context, they also integrated, but only integrated in a limited way. But the reason that they were like that is because we need that. We need that level. We need that model. We need a model of pure spirituality.
Sure,
right? And also, we need to do that within our own lives. This is very, very important as well. We obviously are not living there, we're living here, right? So we're very integrated into the world. But in the way, that's the lesson we have to learn from Yishim Baichai also, that in order to be successful and survive spiritually, for us, living in the wider world, right? We have to have both models. We're going to have the model of the 12 years and the model of the 13th year. Now, obviously we cannot reach the level of 12 years. I mean, that's an amazing level. What that does mean, however, is that every person has to have times where they're purely spiritual, or they engage in things that are purely spiritual, right? You know, the person can say, "Look, my mission is to integrate God into the world, and therefore, you know, I'm going to be in the office from 6 in the morning to 6 at night and never go to a shir." Because it never worked then. If you don't have models of pure spirituality, you don't have anything to bring to the world, right? Rabbi Shimon's idea was he was able to have that intense spirituality of the 12 years and then bring those 12 years into the 13th year. Bring those 12 years into the farmer, right? That intensity. But in order to do that, you first have to engage in the 12-year experience, right? And what that means for every single individual is we all have to have experiences where we're purely spiritual, which is the idea of davening. And not only that, but like what we need to do is that when we do engage in those experiences, we actually shut ourselves down. Like davening is a hard thing to do, right? But the idea of davening is when we daven, we're actually not supposed to think about what's going on in the world. We're supposed to be completely detached. In other words, it can be moments sometimes, or minutes, or an hour, whatever the case is. But when we engage in spiritual things, we need to be completely there. We're not like Rav Shimon that we're there 24 hours a day, so we're not enough, but when we do experience spirituality, it's got to be total. A total immersion and completely absorbed. So that when we finish it, then we can then take it with us and implant it into the world. Right? That's really that's the message. That's the lesson from Rav Shimon Baichai. Right? So, let's take us back to the parasha now. Why did Hashem tell us this lesson of Har Sinai with Shemitah? See, Shemitah is a very interesting mitzvah. Why? Shemitah is a mitzvah that combines both worlds. How so? Where does the mitzvah of Shemitah live, so to speak? Where does it take place? It takes place in Israel, but it takes place on the level of real mundaneness. It takes place in the farmer. That's what's got to keep the mitzvah of Shemitah. Right?
Very basically.
The mitzvah of Shemitah lives in the field, in the farming industry. That's where it lives. On the other hand, the mitzvah of Shemitah requires an incredible connection to Emunah. It requires a great level of spirituality, which is acknowledged by the Torah. The Torah says this is going to be a challenging mitzvah. It's the most challenging mitzvah. It's more challenging than Shabbos. Shabbos is also a test of faith, but Shabbos, a person knows, if he shuts his business, okay, he's back on Sunday. For a day, he can survive. It's challenging. Some people often think that, how can I do that? My best day is Shabbos, whatever the case is, right? All these things, that's a test. That is a test. But all those that have tried it know that at the end of the day, Hashem pulls through. But at the end, it's not a desperate test. I mean, we're not talking about a whole year from there, right? Even if you lose a bit of business, but at the end of the day, Monday you're back in the office. Monday you're doing things again. It's hard to not put a line, but you can survive for a day. It's a donation you can make. It's tough, but it's not hard. Shemitah is an extremely challenging mitzvah. It's the only mitzvah, really, that Hashem says, that Hashem acknowledges the challenge. meaning all mitzvahs are challenging because we have the Yetzer Hara, right? So mitzvahs are meant to be challenging. So we're always going to have the temptation not to do mitzvahs. Some mitzvahs even more than others, right? Some mitzvahs are very tempting to transgress. That's because of the general Yetzer Hara. But over here, there's something unique. The Torah says, I'm giving you a mitzvah that it's going to be the most challenging mitzvah for you. Because you have to shut down for a whole year and you're not going to know where you're going to live from. Right? It's like going back to the time of the Midbar where they went to sleep at night with no food. They had to trust that manna is going to come flying down from heaven. Right? That was in the beginning also a tremendous test of faith until they got used to it. But Shemitah is like that. And you should know that Shemitah is a mitzvah that people failed at. In the first place, Hamikdash, they didn't keep Shemitah. The first place, Hamikdash was destroyed because the Jews mistreated Shemitah. Why? Because it was too hard. They were great people in the first place of English. They learned Torah, they kept mitzvahs, they were great people. They had prophets, I mean, it was unbelievable. It was a glorious time, right? But they messed up on Shemitah because it was too hard. Too hard to think, to shut down for a whole year. Where am I going to eat from?
They couldn't bring the sacrifices to the ones like the wheat in the barley.
They could, in a Shemitah way. They still brought
it. They could. They couldn't grow.
But it grew from the year before, so they could harvest it and take it from the year before. So it wasn't like a nothing grow. But
no, I mean like the first crop that they're supposed to bring first.
Yeah, no, they brought that in the Shemitah year as well. They brought that. They just took one that was growing wild and took it.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
You've actually changed the whole focus. I mean, everybody who was saying how hard it is to buy the fruit and vegetables, it really is directed at the poor farmer.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the buying fruit and vegetables is an Albert story.
Nothing compared to,
I mean, you can eat fish.
Stopping
yeah, no, I mean, it's just, it's complicated. That's not challenging. The challenge is on the farmer.
Only for the farmer.
Right? The challenge on the farmer, it's his livelihood, it's his parnassah. So Hashem says, here you're talking about a person who actually... He's not a great tzaddik, meaning he's not the person who lives a spiritual life. He's the farmer at the end of the day. Right? He's the guy that's pretty mundane. He's pretty down to earth. And we say, you are going to be the guy that's going to now express the ultimate faith, the ultimate surrender. Just give up for a year and I trust in Hashem it will work. Right? And that's the same idea as Lag BaOmer. It's taking the highest levels of intense spirituality and bringing it down to the lowest levels of existence. And that's why we have this concept of Har Sinai. Because Hashem speaks, this concept of Har Sinai was specifically mentioned in this part. Har Sinai was the ultimate spiritual experience. There was nothing ever more spiritual than Har Sinai. Har Sinai is when the Jews saw God, for want of a better expression. They experienced it in absolute reality. Right? There was no world at Har Sinai. At Har Sinai, it says that the world went quiet, the lions stopped roaring, the birds stopped chirping, right? Existence, as we know it, ceased to exist. It was so spiritual that actually the souls of the Jews left their body. You know that? Well, it's more of a Shavuos discussion, but they were so not a physical experience that they couldn't even take it. They couldn't even remain within their physical bodies. Hashem had to revive them after every one of the Ten Commandments, right? Parcho Nishmosen, it says, right? So Har Sinai was the ultimate spiritual experience. So Hashem says, where am I going to mention Har Sinai once again? With the mitzvah of Shemitah, which is the most physical mitzvah. It's the farming mitzvah. Take Har Sinai, take that spiritual experience, the ultimate intensity of spirituality, and apply it to the land. Apply it to a mitzvah that's got to do with the farming. Right? Which is, as I say, the whole idea of Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is this incredible day that we celebrate the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What is one of the concepts of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? What does it stand for? It stands for the concept of taking the most intense spiritual experience, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's experience of the 12 years in the cave, his ultimate connection to Hashem, the Zohar, the deepest and most esoteric parts of Torah, and bringing them all the way down. In fact, the Gemara continues and says, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, when he came out after the 13th year, he actually involved himself in very simple things. He said, his question is, he asked the following question. He says, what is there to fix? What can I fix? So they told him that there's an area where someone was buried in an area, but they're not sure exactly where. And it's a problem for the Kohanim. It was the middle of the road, and the Kohanim, when they come to visit the Beis HaMikdash, they have to go around, they have to detour, because they can't walk anywhere, because they don't know exactly where the grave is. It's a whole business, right? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai went to fix it. He found out exactly where the person was buried, and he erected a monument, so they should know where the grave is, so they can go around, they don't have to go all the way around, they can just avoid the grave, right? He didn't come out of the cave and say, okay, where's the next shira I can give? Right? Because he wanted to take that experience and bring it down to something tangible and connected. And that's the same idea of taking Har Sinai and bringing it down into the land. And that's why Zdaf gets in this parsha, in this Shemitah. In the midst of Shemitah, that's where Hashem mentions the word of Har Sinai. And that's the lesson of Lagbomer for us, that we have to have, on one hand, we have to have these experiences of intense spirituality. We all have to make sure we do have them. We have to have the davening, the learning, the things where we completely detach ourselves from mundane and just completely immerse ourselves in the world of the spiritual, and then connect it to the way we live.
Has anyone else in history kind of reached that level?
Sorry?
Has anyone else in history like reached that?
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Moshe Rabbeinu, Tzadikim. But it says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, it says he was one of the Tanaim of the Mishnah, but he was completely higher. He was in a different level than the rest. He was considered like he was a colleague, but he was really a teacher. I mean, tzaddikim generally are the people that reach high levels.
There's also this story about the rainbow, that there was no rainbow.
Yeah, during that's why there's one of the customs of Lag BaOmer is to play with a bow and arrow. One of the reasons for it, there's a few reasons. One of the reasons for it is because a bow in Hebrew is keshet, which is the same word for a rainbow. And it says that during the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, there was no rainbow. Because the rainbow is a negative symbol. It was a symbol of the flood and etc. So he was able to elevate his generation to such a degree that there was no rainbow.
So now if you see a rainbow, what kind of symbol is it just?
There's a bracha that we make, actually. There's a bracha. In fact, it says when you see a rainbow, the custom is if you see it, there's a bracha you make that we say Hashem remembers his covenant not to bring a flood, etc. But there's a custom, for example, if you see a rainbow, not to tell someone, not to mention that you've seen a rainbow, because like it's not such a... Like a rainbow is like a sign that really, you know, Hashem is not so happy, but he promised not to do anything, so he won't. But
that's beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful, but like it's, I don't know, it's interesting thing. It's an interesting discussion there. Okay, want everyone to make a bracha? And then Shalom Shalom Aleichem only, and elevated and generated a lot of bracha for them.
Thanks.